December 10th, 2012, in Mayapur, India, Nectar of Devotion, Class 12.
So how did you guys do on that? How many of you found the three most important ones? Oh, very good. Give yourselves a hand. Very good. How many of you found the other seven of the 10 most important ones? Whoa. Very good. How many of you found the 10 most important negative ones? Excellent. Any of them? Two of them? Three of them? Five or six? Seven, eight, nine? All 10? Okay, whoa.
Does anyone take?
So what are the three most important? Manali, what are the three most important? Very good. Taking shelter of a spiritual master, getting initiation and instruction, and then following those instructions. Duh, right? Of no use in getting the instructions if you don't follow them. Can we, is it possible to settle down? Is that all right? I don't have a mic here, and if you guys are talking, then I have to scream, and the chemist will be happy because then they'll have to sell some throat syrup, but I won't be happy. But hey, can you guys please be quiet, please?
This is mine.
Excuse me, can I beg you at your feet to be quiet?
Sorry, someone took my stuff.
Bribe you something. Thank you.
Sorry.
It's okay. Okay, turning to chapter 7. So now we're going through some of the items. And this is what we're going to be doing from chapter 7 through chapter 13. It's just going through them one at a time. And basically, Rupa Goswami giving us scriptural evidence and Srila Prabhupada giving us some description. So first, Prabhupada talks about who's a bona fide and who's a bogus guru. Oh, no, the first thing the Prabhupada talks about, actually, which we want to go back to chapter 6, just a brief point on page 53, is that Srila Prabhupada makes the point here that Rupa Goswami is giving us principles and not details.
Yeah.
Principles and not details. A principle is an eternal truth. A detail is changing time, place, and circumstance. Just by the way, I would say that most of the controversies in ISKCON are due to what's a principle and what's a detail. So people all the way on the right, they think everything is a principle, and people all the way on the left, they think everything's a detail. By the way, principles must not be changed, and details must be changed. If you change principles, you're in trouble, and if you don't change details, you're in trouble. It's a principle that you have to change details. It's a principle that you have to change details. That's one of the principles, is that you have to apply knowledge according to circumstances. That's why there's judges. Why do you think there's judges and not just laws? Why bother to have a judge? The judge decides how to apply the law to an individual circumstance or to changes in society. The scriptures cannot be applied the same way. Prabhupada made a nice poem to his spiritual master on his spiritual master's Vyasa Puja Day. And one of it was, "Oldest of all, but a new dress, miracle done, your divine grace." Oldest of all, but a new dress, miracle done, your divine grace. So the oldest of all has to keep being presented in a different dress according to the culture and the times and etc. Language changes. Norms change. You can't just present everything in exactly the same way. You know, some of the analogies that Narada Muni uses or Sukadeva Goswami uses don't make much sense to us anymore. You know, just like bulls walking around a threshing machine. So most people in society don't see bulls walking around a threshing machine or ants on the potter's wheel. You know, he says, just like the ants are walking on the potter's wheel. But most people don't see ants walking on potter's wheels. So those analogies are supposed to take complicated things and compare them to something simple that we know. But an ant on a potter's wheel is just as obtuse to me as the thing it's trying to explain. Anyway, so those are principles and those are details. We could talk about that probably for a couple years. So we're not going to. Okay, going on, but I just want to make that point. Going on to chapter 7, again. Okay. So first thing is guru, and next thing is sadhu. So first three about guru, next thing is sadhu. And of course we have this very famous quote from the bottom of page 60 to the top of page 61, that if your so-called devotional service is not following the scriptures, it's just a disturbance in society. And I made this point on day one, I'm going to make it again. It's everything's got to be from Sadhu Shastra Guru. If somebody says this, that, and the other thing, and they can't back it up from Sadhu Shastra Guru, just ignore it, please. You can ignore it politely, but please ignore it. And make sure that your own, otherwise it's not Anushilanam and Anukulanam. In order to be Anukulyena and Anushilanam, it's got to be following Sadhu Shastra Guru. If you want to know how to please me, you have to ask me. You can't just make it up. I mean, you can, but it might not work. So if we do devotional service without following scriptures, that's simply a disturbance to society. And we find the definition here is that of the sahajiyas. Right, Prabhupada says here, those who do not strictly follow the principles of revealed scriptures are generally called sahajiyas. Those who have imagined everything to be cheap, who have their own concocted ideas, who do not follow the scriptural injunctions. So sahajiya is somebody who, they're making up their own process. They're not following the scriptures. They're saying, okay, we're going to dress, you know, we're men, but we're going to dress like gopis, and we're going to have illicit sex and take intoxication, and we're going to chant Hare Krishna anyway, and it's all going to work. They're making up their own process. So they have some attraction for Krishna. They do have some attraction for Krishna, undoubtedly. But it's not Anukulyena, and it's not Anukulyena Krishna Anu Shilanam. It's not Shilanam that's Anu. It's not Kulyena that's Anu. It's they're making it up out of their own. And maybe it's not going to please Krishna. If you're going to make lunch for me and you give me just greasy chilies, I won't be pleased. Because you didn't ask me, do you like greasy chilies? Does that make sense to everybody? Yes? Okay. So that's what sahajiya is. Sahajiya is going to make up, they're going to make up their own process. So we have guru, we have sadhu, we have shastra. Now look at this in the first 10 items, page 62, is asking questions, inquiring. Sometimes we think, oh, I don't want to ask questions. If there were no questions, there'd be no shastra. You know that, right? All the shastras, just questions and answers. And some of them were challenging questions. But some of them were challenging. They weren't just like, how do I do this? You know, Arjuna says to Krishna, I don't understand your instructions. You tell me to give up abominable activities and then you tell me to fight. That seems pretty abominable to me. Why are you giving me two opposite instructions? So Arjuna asked difficult, challenging questions. Maharaj Parikshit asked, yes?
I don't understand how the quote that Prabhupada writes there is related to inquiring.
Ah, okay. If you're serious, you'll ask questions. A serious student asks questions. You all know that story of when Lord Chaitanya was hearing the explanation from Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya on Vedanta Sutra. For 7 days, Lord Chaitanya didn't say anything. He just sat there. And Sarvabhauma Bhattacharya was not pleased. He said, I don't know. Are you understanding? Are you not understanding? Now, in some parts of the world, people are trained in school to do that. There are some schools and some cultures where they train all the students to just sit. And they think if they ask a question, They're being disrespectful. This is how you train people to be shudras. And those systems of education were designed to oppress people and make them into shudras. Part of Krishna consciousness is asking questions. It's in the 10 most important positive injunctions given by Rupa Goswami. Okay, being prepared to give up something for Krishna, living in a sacred place, and I'll bring tomorrow, hopefully. I remember. There's a number of these 64 that sound alike. I'm sure you've noticed that. So I'm gonna. I have a paper. I left it back at my room. That take each of them and show the subtle differences. So accepting only what's necessary. Anybody read this and find this interesting? It wasn't what you expected, was it? You looked at the title and you thought it was about what?
Materialism.
Some material thing. You thought it was like not don't have too many saris. You know? And then you read it and found out it was about what? Don't take too big of a vow. Don't promise things you can't keep. Don't overpromise and underdeliver. Don't say to Krishna, Krishna, I'm going to chant 100 rounds a day and then only chant 2. Interesting, isn't it? I always found that fascinating. Because also in the Nectar of Instruction, we read that one of the causes of fall down is to one of the 6 negatives. You did Nectar of Instruction. To over-endeavor for mundane achievements which are very difficult to obtain. And that's what we thought, that's what you thought this was, I bet, right?
Yes.
When you saw it, accepting only what's necessary. Oh, I remember that from the Nectar of Instruction. That's over-endeavoring for mundane things that are very difficult to obtain. And then you read it and said, oops. This is something else. This is something else. This is saying don't take on vows and austerities in Krishna consciousness that you can't keep. Far better to do something less well than something better poorly. You know, they say that it's the victory of the good over the best. You know, I would much rather people do something than do it well than do nothing. You know, you make a plan to do something all the way up here and nothing happens. It's much better to do something here than to have a plan for here that fails. So do what you actually can do and then move forward. Bhaktivinoda Thakura says don't go too fast and don't go too slow. Yes.
Better to be good than great.
Better be good than great and fall on your nose. Now if you can be great and be great, that's fine. But if trying to be great means you fall on your nose, better to be good and stand up. Yes.
How do you reconcile this with the Srila Prabhupada's instructions saying aim for the rhino?
Yeah.
Okay, but step by step. So you don't fly to the top of the building, you walk up the stairs, you take the lift. You know, you're aiming for the rhino, but if you've never, you know, used a bow and arrow before in your life, then learn how to use a bow and arrow first. And then go and aim for the rhino. Don't just go out and aim for the rhino with your little butter knife. You'll just get smashed.
But Krishna preserves what you
Yes, he does, but as part of being a servant, it's your business to have some brains.
Where does it say that?
That's one of the 26 qualities of a devotee. You should be expert. Prabhupada says you should know something of everything. Good, I've trained you well. And everything is something. Part of the 26 qualities is you should be expert. So we should do what we're actually capable of doing. Now, it is true that there's something called empowerment. Mm.
Yes.
So it is a fact that if you're asked to do something that you think is impossible and you pray for empowerment, you may get it. It's true. But I see here it's just a question of being honest and humble, this injunction. Be honest and humble. Don't be dishonest and proud.
It's like, don't be a shooting star.
Yeah, exactly. You want to be steady. You want to be steady. Yes, Krishna can empower each of us, and he will empower each of us, to do things well beyond our capacity. Krishna will definitely empower us to do things well beyond our capacity. But part of our responsibility is to make sure that we're here for the long haul. You know, you don't want to burn yourself out. One friend of mine had a husband who, after many, many years, left Krishna consciousness. And I asked her why, and she said, well, he was working 15 hours a day, 7 days a week, and it was here in Mayapur, on various projects. And after many years, he said, I don't know, even know who I am anymore. I never had a chance to be myself. So in Bhagavad Gita, Prabhupada says there's three kinds of activities: ordinary, desired, and emergency. Ordinary means according to our psychophysical nature. You could say according to Varna and Ashram. It also means our regulated devotional service, our 16 nouns, our three gayatris, going to Mangalartik, studying Srila Prabhupada's book. The ordinary activities. So either according to our regular sadhana, ordinary according to our ashram, ordinary according to our varna, etc., that we're using in Krishna's service. Then emergency activities is exactly that. You know, there's nobody to do this, there's a catastrophe, and you have to do something you're not good for. Emergencies should be emergencies. If there's an emergency 365 days a year, there's something wrong with the management. That there should not be an emergency more than a few days a year, at the most. You know, not more than a half an hour to an hour in a week, and not more than maybe 6 or 7 days in a year. And then desired activities, in the ordinary sense, is like hobbies. You know, little things that you like to do. Maybe you like to write poetry. Maybe you like to grow flowers. Something that's not part of your regular duties, but something that you do. So first of all, your ordinary activities should be according to your psychophysical nature. They should be something that you enjoy, something you can maintain over the long haul. Keep emergency duties to emergencies, and have some nice hobbies and recreation. Also in the sixth chapter, Krishna says, one who is temperate in eating, sleeping, working, and recreation can mitigate all pains by practice of the yoga system. So we should have some recreation in Krishna consciousness. Recreation. If we want to make it till the end. Otherwise, if you try to be something that you're not, and try to do something that you're not, and you're not empowered for it, and it's not your ability, then you're not going to get what you want to get. And we see this happen to a lot of people. They reach too high too fast. So you don't want to go too slowly either. You know, you don't want to go 20 years and you're not initiated, for example. I know people like that. You know, like 30 years, and they're a bhakta for 30 years. You're staying. You know, so you don't want to go too slowly. And if it's time, if you're ready to take on more austerity, you're ready to do more surrender, then for goodness sakes, do it. But at the same time, don't try to do something that you can't maintain, that you're not happy with. Just because someone else says, well, you should do that. But if you can't actually do it, don't do it. Okay? Sensible? Prabhupada's so sensible and down to earth and practical and real. Okay, fasting on Ekadasi. Nice to be studying this on Ekadasi. So the principle, obviously, is not just to fast. The principle is to minimize really what it should be is that you're not spending time in the kitchen, you're not spending time shopping, you're just chanting. Of course, sometimes on Ekadasi we make fancier preparations. Or what I found, you know, as a cook, is that on a regular day, making dal rice, chapatis, and sabji was easy. I just knew it. You know, you just did it every day. And dal's really easy. Dal and rice are really easy to make. Right? The only really difficult thing was the sabji, if you made a simple rice. But boy, Ekadasi. You had to do so much more cut-up, wasn't it? You know, because everything was vegetables. So you had to do so much more cut-up, and you really had to think about the menu. I'm going to make this. The other day, it's just easy. Just what kind of sabji am I going to make? What kind of beans am I going to use? You know, am I going to put some spices in the rice? You know, it was a real simple thing. You hardly had to think about it. But Ekadasi, you had to plan the menu, you had to make sure you had ingredients. I found it was like more, right? And I remember one of my kids saying to me, what's the point? And my answer to him was, at least you're remembering this is a special day. So if the only thing, well, if the only thing you're doing is you're eating special food on Ekadasi, if that's all you're doing, at least there's something saying there's something special about this day. And one day, you might decide, hey, maybe let me do a little more. So I remember when one of my students and my son-in-law, they said, you know, why, actually that's not how it started. It started by circumstances. But anyway, they said, why don't we actually do a full on Ekadasi, you know, with no food, no water, and staying up all night. And it was sort of a, it was, they were young guys, and they were kind of a, hey, yeah, that was sort of the mood. Hey, can you stay up all night and not drink any water? I don't know. Can you? Yeah. You know, they were challenging each other. So I don't know if that's Anya Bilasi Tansun. But anyway, that was their mood. So we all kind of got into it. And it was so much fun. And then we would do that every Ekadasi, stay up all night, not have any food, not have any water. And then gradually, we started chanting extra rounds. So, you know, gradually, like that. But the real idea of Ekadasi, just like in the Jewish and Christian and Muslim traditions, they have a Sabbath. For the Muslims on Friday, the Jews and some Christians on Saturday, and the Christians on Sunday, they have one day where you're supposed to do no work. It's supposed to be dedicated to prayer. You don't do your business. You don't do your regular stuff. And like the strict Jews who don't work, they won't light a fire. Like Krishna talks about the sannyasis, people who light no fire and do no work. So they won't light a fire, which means they can't cook. So of course, just like we invent Ekadasi prep, so they invent Sabbath preps. Either things that don't require cooking, like salad, or things where they can turn on the oven on before the Sabbath on a Friday night and they leave it on. They leave it on a low heat overnight. Or what they'll sometimes do is they'll have someone who's not Jewish comes and turns the fire on. I mean, they get, if you really want to laugh, they get so into this not work, because they use toilet paper, but they say if you're ripping the toilet paper, that's work.
Oh my God.
So that before the Sabbath, they rip a whole bunch of toilet paper in advance and leave it stacked up. Isn't that interesting? That's called Yimah. And also, another thing that is interesting is they won't drive. And because they have to go to a temple on the Sabbath and they can't drive on the Sabbath, what does that do? Yes. It means they all live very close to each other. So if you're not allowed to drive, if you have to go to the temple every Saturday and you're not allowed to drive on Saturday, you have to live close enough to walk. Well, that's interesting. I don't know if that was intended. But the principle is still, it's a good principle. That, you know, once a week, and we do it once every 2 weeks, there's a day where you stop your regular activities. Now, generally, in the Hare Krishna movement, we don't do that. And I see two reasons why we don't do that. The biggest one is that our culture around us is not a Vaishnav culture. And so everything doesn't close on Ekadasi. You know, if you go to these Muslim countries, everything closes on Friday.
Yeah.
It's just closed. And in Israel, everything's closed on Saturday. Used to be in America, at least, that things were closed on Sunday. Now, I think the only thing closed on Sunday is liquor shops. I think they're closed like Sunday morning or something like that. And that's, those have gone as the societies have become less and less and less religious. But the ideal would be that in society in general, on Ekadasi, everything just stops. All the shops are closed, there's no work, there's no school, there's nothing. And if people in general are fasting, then you wouldn't have to cook. You'd have to cook something, of course, for the Lord, but you wouldn't have to cook some big meal. And of course, I'm seeing gradually, you know, more and more devotees spending Ekadasi doing extended chanting. And when I was just now in Vrindavan, there were some devotees who were staying up all night doing kirtan. So that's very lovely. And actually, Bhaktivinoda Thakur talks about one way to increase your attentiveness in chanting is to have some times when all you do all day is chant. And like on an Ekadasi, he also suggests Janmashtami. Of course, in most of our ISKCON temples, chanting all day on Janmashtami is impossible. You know, just sometimes getting your 16 rounds done, you're still chanting them at 11 o'clock at night because you've been running around all day, right?
Yes.
Getting the kids ready for the drama and making the flower decorations, and they've kept you busy since 5 in the morning, and you're like 11 o'clock, oh my God, I still have 3 rounds to chant, isn't it? I remember one Jen Mosme actually hid. I actually went back to my room and just hid and just read Krishna book. When I came back from the temple, they said, where were you? I said, it's Jen Mosme. I was reading Krishna book. But it's interesting. You know, sometimes our idea of a festival is just work harder. But the tradition is more that these were for bhajan. But anyway, the idea of Ekadasi is this is a time for concentrated just hearing and chanting. This is a time for concentrated remembrance, to take a little break, even if everything else we're doing is for Krishna. Just like we have our sadhana time in the morning, which is, this is our time just to hang out with Krishna. We may be working all day for Krishna. This is our time just to be with Krishna. And then something which I don't think I can really explain, that why is the last of the ten most important items giving respect to the banyan trees? I cannot explain this. If you ask me, my answer is I don't know. Now, Srila Prabhupada expands this beyond banyan trees to cows, Brahmins, Vaishnavas, Tulsis, etc. Okay, now we have the 10 most important negatives, not all of which is in this chapter. Giving up the company of non-devotees, and Bhaktivinoda Thakur explains, yes. Don't ask me that question, because I already told you I can answer it.
Okay. In the original list of the 10 items, it says worshipping sacred trees like the banyan trees, not just the banyan trees.
Well, that's real. It's, if you go back to Bhakti Rasamrita Sindhu, you know, to see what the original Sanskrit is.
Mataji?
Yes?
My husband told me years ago, he said how they learned in Gurukul that you should offer your respects to the banyan trees because during Brahmamurti hour, the demigods, they sit on the branches of the banyan tree.
Oh, that's cool. I still wonder why it's in the 10 most important items. I'm not questioning why it's there at all, but I'm questioning why it's in the 10 most important items. And my answer is, I don't know. Is it something we emphasize in our Hare Krishna movement?
No.
Definitely not.
I mean, aside from Krishna saying of trees, he's the banyan.
Yeah, but it's not, we don't have a banyan worshipping program. I've never seen it. Never seen it. Even like in our Honolulu temple, there's a huge banyan tree in the backyard. It's the biggest banyan tree, I think, at least on that island. I'm not sure if in all the islands, but at least in the island of Oahu, it's the biggest banyan tree. We never do anything. But we don't have like a banyan worshipping regularly. So my answer is just, I don't know. Now, among the 10 most important negatives is giving up the company of non-devotees. Now, this doesn't mean we never have anything to do with non-devotees, but we don't become intimate friends with non-devotees. Now, this one, sometimes we didn't with this time, but sometimes we had a lot of questions about this one, about not accepting unfit disciples, constructing temples, or reading many books. I actually got one question about the book. The main thing here is we're not interested just in collecting for collecting, for pride. You know, that it's not really about numbers. Even though we glorify numbers of books distributed, Prabhupada said, really, it's about your sincerity. It's not just, you know, well, I've distributed 102 books, and you only distributed 93. No, it's not about that. And you don't get into that mentality of just bigger, better, more, 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 numbers, 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 numbers. That's not what it's about. It's not about, let me collect more disciples than you, let me read more books than you. You know, in the academic world, I remember one of my professors saying, they have this rule for professors, publish or perish. If you don't keep writing articles and publishing them, you can't work as a professor. So one of my professors told me that they expect for every article 300 references. Now, I will tell you, they're not reading 300 books. You really want to know a little secret. When you see in these PhD theses, dissertations, or you see in these scholarly articles 200, 300 references, please do not believe that anybody actually read all of those. What they did was they went through it, and they found a quote on page 300, so it looked like they read up to 300, and they quoted that.
Oh.
just wanted to sound smart.
Yeah. Or, you know,
right?
Exactly. Or, you know, they read somebody quotes somebody else and they use that other one.
Mm-hmm.
You know, instead of saying it's in Mr. Smith quotes Mr. Price, and so they quote Mr. Price directly without saying they quoted it in Mr. Smith's book. I hope you understand. Anyway, they make some ways of making it look like they've read a lot more than they've actually read, just to be impressive. So, you know, I've built many temples, and I have many disciples, and I've read many, many books. But Krishna's not really impressed by that. He's impressed by love. Yes?
But actually, everybody knows that in the scientific community. It's only outside the scientific community.
Yes, they all know that. It's actually quite interesting at the higher levels of education what they admit to each other. Quite interesting. I found it just fascinating. You know, at the master's level, they still have this mood that we know everything and we're gods. And empiric knowledge is the clue to reality, is the key to reality. And as soon as you get to the PhD level, that all goes away. And then you have this required course on the philosophy of research, and they tell you, actually, empiricism doesn't give you knowledge. It's very interesting. And they tell you, they do. I still have all my notes, you know, the six things wrong with empirical knowledge. And I'm thinking, this could be a devotee class, you know. Why our senses and logic can't give us reliable knowledge. And then they say, now go and do your research. Your research will all be useless. Now go do it. Okay, respecting the demigod. Straightforwardness in ordinary dealings. So this is not an item of material piety. It's not an item of material piety. We're not doing this to be a pious person to go to the heavenly planets and so we won't get bad karma. It said Krishna wants us to be straightforward. He doesn't want us to be lying and cheating. We shouldn't be lying, cheating, and stealing. Unless Krishna personally walks up to you. Krishna steps off the altar, walks down all those stairs, walks up to you and says, you go steal and lie and cheat. If you hear Krishna's flute and he calls you in the forest, then you can leave your husband and dance with him, whatever. But, you know, otherwise, no lying, cheating, stealing, please. That we should, not dealing on the black market. We should be straightforward. Otherwise, it's very embarrassing for Krishna. It's really, really embarrassing for Krishna. Just like we'd be embarrassed if our children or our employees or somebody did something illegal. So Krishna still loves his devotees even if they do nasty things. Just like we love our children even if they do nasty things. But Krishna, it's not nice. It doesn't look good for Krishna. So, you know, there are times when Krishna wants his devotees to do outrageous things to show that they love him so much that they're willing to ruin their own reputations for him. But that's on a different level. Equilibrium and loss and gain. I find this very interesting as one of the 10 most important do not items. Keep your emotions under control. Don't freak out. How to be practical about it? Give your emotions to Krishna. Everything in this world is so, so, so temporary. Our whole life is 8 billionths of a second for Lord Brahma. You know, 5 years from now, you won't even remember what you were freaking out about today. You might remember that you freaked out, but you won't remember what you freaked out about. Like, I remember one time I got in a really big fight with my husband, but I can't remember what we were fighting about. You know, I remember it was a really big argument. We were going to go see a sister. We didn't end up going to see her. We turned around and went back home. I can't remember at all what we were fighting about. And how important is all these things? You know, we're thinking, oh, I've lost this thing. I remember one time in Puerto Rico, I was giving a Sunday feast class about, you know, just this sort of thing, being equiposed in gain and loss. And I'd been in a hurry to give the class, and I hadn't locked the door to my room. I came back, and somebody had stole my wallet and all the money that I had in the world. Probably only about $100 or something. And I came back, I'm like, okay, Krishna, asking me to practice what I teach. But I don't care now. What does it matter now? You know, that was 12 years ago. doesn't no longer matters to me now. So we you know, just get some perspective. Some wonderful thing happens, some terrible thing happens. And you know what? Life goes on. You know, even the psychologists, they say if you win a lot of money, you know, you get a big inheritance, you win the lottery, you get a lot of money, you're happier for 6 months, and by the end of the 6 months, you're just as happy as you were before. And if you become paralyzed, you're depressed for 6 months, and after 6 months, you're just as happy as you were before. That we end up going back. So at the time, we're thinking, this is a horrible thing, and this is a wonderful thing. It's not. And, you know, 10 years later, it'll just be a story if you remember it. Oh, you know what happened to me? You know, and it's just an interesting story. And that's it. It's done. It's over. It's not really important. None of that gain and loss is happening to me anyway. Yes?
So does that mean that when something bad is happening, like, let's say my husband dies, right? Like,
he will.
Like, you know, when I'm not
but sooner,
ready, but
sooner
I mean,
than
I not live
you're
anymore,
not going to be ready for it.
Or will I be like, oh, well, that's life. I mean,
it's very interesting you ask that question because there's one place in the Bhagavad Gita, and honestly, where I can't remember, where Prabhupada said that one should be callous even at the death of a very near relative.
Really?
Yeah. He uses the word callous.
Callous?
If you always walk barefoot, your feet, the bottoms of your feet become hard and thick. That's a callous. So callous generally means hard and thick and cold. But we find... that when Abhimanyu died, that Arjuna cried.
Yes.
And he was angry, and he said, I'm going to kill Jayadrath. When Draupadi's five children were killed, she also asked Arjuna, she said, go get Aswatthama and kill him. Of course, later she changed her mind. He said, all right, I'll get him. I'll kill him, and you can take a bath standing on his head. Of course, he didn't end up killing him. But she had certainly very strong feelings. Of course, then we find Srivastakur. His son died in the middle of the kirtan, and the women started crying, and he told them to be quiet. He said, you're going to disturb Mahaprabhu's kirtan. Cut it out. He said, anyway, he died in the middle of a kirtan with Mahaprabhu. What's better than that? At the end of the kirtan, Mahaprabhu said, something went on here. He's so funny. Of course he knows what happened. But he said, something went on here. Something happened. And he said, oh, nothing, nothing, nothing. And then he found out Srivastakura's son died. And then he said, why didn't you tell me? And then, of course, he temporarily brought him back into his body, and he said, my lord, I'm going wherever you want me to go. I'm your servant. And everybody was pacified. You know, why do we lament? We lament because we think this person or this situation was going to complete me, going to give me shelter and going to meet my needs. We're mostly lamenting for ourselves. But this isn't saying we should repress our feelings. It's not what it's saying. I mean, that'll just make you sick. But that we should come to the point that our real happiness comes in serving Krishna, that we're not just overwhelmed by the material circumstances, that we're not just, you know, being buffeted about by the modes of material nature. How do you do that is described mostly in 14.22 to 25 of Bhagavad Gita. But anyway, my main thing is I think that it's important that this is in one of the 10 most important negatives. That it's something very important not to be emotionally affected by the things of this world, to be emotionally affected by Krishna. So yesterday this one lady was talking to me how she had had some catastrophe with a devotee man, where this devotee man appeared to love her and take care of her, and actually he didn't either love her or take care of her, and he cheated her, and etc., etc. It was a particularly sad story. And she was devastated, and she was crying. And I said, you know, crying is wonderful. Why don't you cry for Krishna? Why are you crying for this man? So this man's not worthy of your tears. And I said in your heart, it's probably like an earthquake right now, right? She's like, yeah. I said, why don't you give it to Krishna? So we're not trying to stop the earthquake. We're not trying to stop the volcano. And she said, but all my crying is just material. I said, but you can go to Krishna and say, Krishna, I wish I could cry for you like that. I wish I had so much love and attachment for you that I was crying for you, that my heart was broken for you, instead of for this guy who was just irresponsible and cheating. I said, he's not worth it. Now, of course, if you feel separation from your husband because you feel separation from a Vaishnava, that's something. That's on another platform. So if your feeling is, oh, now my husband's dead, how will I get food and shelter? And, you know, how will anybody take care of me? How will I get enough money? People will, I'll lose my social position as a nice married woman, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, that's thinking this person is going to fulfill my needs. But if your relationship is on the platform of Krishna consciousness and you feel separation, actually, Ramananda Roy said the most painful thing is separation from a Vaishnava. Depends on what level your relationship is. And then we can feel, you know, just like we feel separation, we want to feel separation from Krishna. Respecting the demigods, not giving pain to any living entity. Again, I find it interesting that this is in one of the 10 most important negatives. Krishna says this in the Bhagavad Gita also, that we shouldn't be a source of anxiety for anyone, any living entity, not just devotees. We shouldn't cause pain to anyone. Not just in the name of my service, I'm going to cause pain to people. Well, it's my service, Prabhu. You know, one devotee had me look at something that he wrote, and the language that he was using was very crude. And I said, my dear devotee, I think if you use this crude language, no one is going to read your book. And he said, well, this is just the way I think. I don't want to take the trouble to write in another way. And I said, well, that's not very good. You're going to say to people that reading your book, well, I'm sorry, I'm too lazy to write in a respectful way. Please read it anyway. So here Prabhupada's talking about animal killing, but any kind of, any living entity. Huh?
Mosquitoes.
They're aggressors.
You're aggressors.
They're aggressors. You can kill aggressors. Somebody's trying to kill you. You're allowed to act in self-defense. But then there was that Vasudev who had worms eating his body. When they fell down, he put them back. But don't imitate. I mean, if you can actually feel that way, don't just falsely imitate.
Even mosquitoes in the dumb.
Even mosquitoes in the dumb. If they're trying to kill you. They're trying to kill you. You can decide, but certainly. Anyway, this principle of not giving pain to anyone. Remember, it's a principle, not a detail. Do you remember Rupa Goswami is giving us a principle, not a detail? But it is a principle not to give pain to any living entity, and not that I'm nice to the cows and then I yell at my husband. Yes. So not to give pain to any living entity. Generally, when we give pain to other living entities, it is selfish. I'm giving pain to you because you're not giving me what I want, or something like that. Okay. Not being neglectful in ordinary dealings basically means to be honest. Talking mostly about dealings with money. But generally in ordinary doings, we shouldn't, whatever our job is, we're doing it for Krishna. Why should we be neglectful? Okay, here's a question from chapter 3, where Prabhupada said, the question here is, without being elevated to what position can one not come to the principle? Prabhupada was saying, without being elevated to the position of jnana, which means the position of knowing that you're not this body. So until we've come to the position of knowing we're not this body, we're not going to be able to be fixed in our service. Okay, chapter 6, one of the instructions states not to earn livelihood from lecturing from Bhagavatam or Bhagavad Gita. This is a great question, by the way. These days I've seen devotees getting paid to do kirtan in our temples and festivals. Does this fall in the same category? Is it an offense? It's interesting that Srila Prabhupada would sometimes say about being invited to give lectures that if they're not going to pay, he wouldn't go. And sometimes he said about books that we shouldn't give the books away for free, that we should get money for them. So sometimes asking people to pay is necessary for them to value it. You know, if someone says that we want you to come and lecture on Bhagavad Gita and they won't pay your airfare or your train fare, or, you know, you can say, sorry, then you don't really care about what I'm doing. And I see this as part of the principle of not giving the glories of the holy name to the faithless. You know, why should you spend your time on giving something to somebody that doesn't want it? And if they don't want it enough to give you something in exchange for it, then it may not be worth it. Also, there's a principle that sacrifice without remuneration to the priest is in the mode of ignorance. So if people are taking something from you and they're not giving you anything in exchange, then that sacrifice is in the mode of ignorance. I see here it's a question of mentality. If your mentality is lecturing on Srimad Bhagavatam is my job, it's how I maintain myself. And if I didn't get paid, then I wouldn't do kirtan. Now, if you're going to do kirtan anyway, you're lecturing on Bhagavatam anyway, and you're living off the donations, that's a brahminical activity. Brahmins have to live too. I mean, otherwise you'd have a situation where people had to have another job. I mean, how silly. You'd be saying, okay, you have to have an outside, you're a Brahmin, you have to have an outside job working in a bank so that when you do kirtan and when you give Bhagavatam lectures, you don't have to get any donation for it. I one time heard a devotee talk about this in class. You know, that he was saying that the people who could come to the temple and do service without getting anything in exchange were higher. And I thought, well, that means the householders who have jobs and do, you know, some few hours of free service on the weekend are higher than the brahmacharis who live in the ashram and are maintained in exchange for their service, which obviously doesn't make any sense. If you're working full time as a preacher, you've got to be maintained. What are you going to do? Well, you have to have a rich aunt or something that gives you a big inheritance. Yeah.
We can have adopt a preacher.
You can start that. Sounds good to me. Anyway, it's a question of mentality. I remember once we had a temple president who was getting a salary, and he would come in at 9:30 or 10 in the morning to do his job, and then he would go home. That's not good. You know? Prabhupada's talking here about people, they're smoking, they're drinking, they're doing this, they're doing that, and then it's their job to give a lecture, and they, you know, they do all the dramatics and they cry and the audience cries and oh Krishna, you know. Yeah, this goes on not just among, you know, Hindus or Vaishnavas, it goes on among Christians and Muslims, and you know, you got these Christian preachers, they have their own private sinful life, and then they come up and like, Jesus, you know, and they're getting rich off of it. So that's disgusting. But I mean, just think about it. What's the ideal situation for a devotee is if they can maintain their family in something that's related to Krishna. You know, if you interpret it that you should never be able to get a livelihood from something that's Krishna conscious, then we'll have to close all those shops here. Does that make sense to you? I mean, if a grahasta can maintain his family by distributing Prabhupada's books, should we say, no, better to work at a bank? Of course not.
I guess so, it's just when it comes to like chanting the holy name, like if you maintain yourself as a musician.
But suppose you are a musician.
But then, yeah, so are people coming to listen to music or are they coming to get purified?
Who cares? Are they coming to the restaurant to eat or are they coming to get purified?
So I guess it doesn't matter, right?
Not from their perspective. Whose perspective does it matter? Your perspective. If you're running a restaurant, you don't have a sign on the door. Only people already on the platform of Uttam Bhakti can walk in the door. You don't say that.
So it's your intention.
It's your intention. Yeah, it's what? What's the word? What's the word? Come on, definition of bhakti. What's the word?
Anukulyena.
Your intention has to be to please Krishna. And Anya Bilasita Sunyam.
You can't. No one knows your intention from you.
That's true, isn't it? But there are some symptoms. So if I'm doing kirtans to make money and the rest of my life when I'm not doing kirtans has nothing to do with bhakti, that's a pretty prime symptom. Okay, so after I finish the kirtan and I collect the money, then I smoke a cigarette and drink a beer and go see the latest whatever Superman movie and then there's probably an indication that I'm not anukulyena and not anyabhilasitasa. But if I'm a devotee, and I love to do kirtan, and I have musical talent, that's what I do, which could mean either that I'm a shudra with musical talent or that I'm a Brahmin engaged in just chanting the holy names, depending on where it might be. And that's all I want to do all day. And then people start saying, hey, and this happens to people I know. People start saying, hey, can you come to our temple and do kirtan? We'll pay your airfare. We'll give you a place to stay.
We'll give you a donation. Hey, can you come to our temple and do kirtan? We'll give you a place to stay. We'll give you a donation. Pretty soon you're invited by places outside the temple. They said, hey, can you come and do kirtan? And pretty soon you find that people are asking you to do kirtan all the time. And they're giving you enough money that you can live and you don't need to do anything else. Should you stop?
No.
Should you stop and say, oh, I can't chant Hare Krishna all day, every day anymore? Because that's how I'm living. Would that make sense? Would that make sense?
Yes.
That would make sense to you? I should say, no, I'm going to stop chanting. And I'm only going to chant, I'm only going to do kirtan 3 hours a week. So the rest of the time I can do something to maintain myself. Or am I going to do puja for 6 or 7 or 8 hours? Exactly.
And then somebody will just get paid.
Exactly. Now, but it's a question of mentality. And if you say, well, if you don't pay me, I'm not going to give a class. That's another symptom. Now, although Prabhupada will sometimes say, we're not going to go to a particular place unless they pay. You know, if people invite me someplace to preach, they have to pay my airfare. Where am I going to get the money to pay my airfare for? When am I supposed to work? From 1 to 2 in the morning? You understand? So, and no one's adopted me yet.
Adoption.
But I think you understand my point. You know, I figure if they don't care enough to pay for me to come, then they're not really interested in what I have to offer. Now, sometimes I might go places without that. But even if no, you know, these people who love kirtan, even if nobody takes care of them, guess what? They're still chanting. They're chanting in their home when nobody's paying. They're chanting all the time. If you love the shastra, you're going to be reading and studying the shastra all the time, not just for your classes. And not just to impress people. But anyway, I see it's a mood and it's intention, and there are some symptoms of what is it, your intention. The main symptom is, if I don't get paid, will I stop doing it? Am I? Is that my purpose for doing it? Or would I do it anyway? Yeah. If I'm going to be preaching on Bhagavatam anyway, and I'm going to be chanting Hare Krishna anyway, whether anybody gives me a donation or not, or anybody facilitates me or not, you know, and what is the rest of my life like? Is this just my job and I have another life, or is it my life? That's a very good question. And I see that it's something that really we haven't quite worked out on a practical level in our Hare Krishna movement. We haven't quite figured this out. What do we do with people who are doing, you know, basically brahminical activities full time, especially if they have a family? Can a guru become infirm because of the disciples not following or because he did something abominable? Yes. Why is it important that one live in Mathura? Because sacred places increase our devotional, the efficacy of our devotion. And if you can't live in those places, then at least make a sacred place in your room or your house. Make a sacred place in your mind. Prabhupada says that reading Bhagavad Gita, Sisi Nenodi is sufficient knowledge to understand Krishna consciousness, so we shouldn't bother reading other books. If so, why did he write and translate so many books? Well, it's fun to read these other books. Don't you like reading all these books about Krishna? This person didn't put Krishna book there. We like reading Krishna book. Prabhupada said if you just read one line in his books, you can become perfect. But Tushanti Charamanticha, isn't it fun reading Prabhupada's books? Yeah. And reading the, you know, reading the books of the Goswamis, why not? Also, it's very nice for preaching to show that we have a great scope of philosophy. But the point is, shouldn't be collecting just to collect. Oh, I've read the Bhagavatam 108 times and the Bhagavad Gita 50 times, and I have a library of 10,000 books. don't do that. What's the difference between bhakti not being conditioned by anything and some circumstances making our practice of bhakti more difficult, such as low birth, not being properly situated in varnashram, etc.? Bhakti is not dependent on those things. I gave the example of the class. We could have a class outside. This class is not dependent on having a classroom.
It's not dependent on a classroom. It's not dependent on a flip chart. It's not dependent on the study guides. It's not dependent on the handout. It's not dependent on any of those things. But it's nice to have them. It makes it easier.
But what is the difference between easier and dependent?
Dependent, it can't happen without them.
Yeah, and this can happen, but it's more difficult.
Yeah.
In which ways?
Because we're conditioned. You know, if I'm not conditioned, then there's no impediment at all. If I'm completely in love, there's no impediment. There was this song when I was young, ain't no mountain high enough, ain't no river wide enough to keep me from getting to you, babe. So, of course, that's not true in the world. In worldly love, if the mountain's high enough or the river's wide enough, love's going to stop. But if you love Krishna, there's no mountain high enough and there's no river wide. It doesn't matter. If you're the cows on top of Govardhan Hill and the cowherd men are trying to stop you with sticks and Govardhan Hill's covered with rocks, and you're still going to run down Govardhan Hill to see Krishna. You're not going to wait for favorable circumstances. It's the middle of the night and the Vrindavan forest is full of tigers. And you're only 13 years old. And you're a married woman in a very conservative society, and you're right in the middle of cooking. You have a chapati on the stove, and you're feeding your husband, and your mother-in-law and father-in-law are there, and Krishna plays his flute. And you don't say, I'm going to wait for a favorable circumstance. I'll wait until it's light outside. I'll wait until my husband says I can go. You just go. But we don't want to go to ourselves and other people and say, just become Krishna conscious, whatever. We're not usually determined enough. If it's too hard, we'll give up. So what we try to do as a movement is we try to make the material circumstances easier. If we just said, come and study Prabhupada's books out in the fields, you know, we try to make it attractive. Like Prabhupada said, if we just sit under a tree and say, come, people won't come. If you have this beautiful temple, people will come. You know, it's practical. But if you start thinking bhakti's dependent on it, it's not. Bhakti's not dependent on anything other than bhakti. Good point. I don't know if everybody got that. It's deep. Can you please clarify why there is a conflict of interest with respect to Buddha being an incarnation of Krishna in spite of being mentioned in Srimad Bhagavatam? Because although Buddha is an incarnation, what he taught was without reference to the scriptures. And the point is that bhakti has to be within reference to the scriptures. So he did that for a purpose. He did that for a temporary purpose. But we don't consider that worship of Buddha is worship of a saintly person or worship of an incarnation because it's opposed to the scriptures. Yes.
Referring to the same topic, Rupa Goswami says here in the Bhagavad Gita, Rupa Goswami says that the falls of Buddha cannot be accepted as devotees, right? And then the last sentence that Prabhupada writes on that topic, he says, so for the atheists, Lord Buddha's preaching is atheism so that they will follow him and thus be tricked into devotional service to Lord Buddha. So it seems like those
it
two
seems like it's a contradiction.
Yeah.
I see it as a intermediate step. I see Buddhism as an intermediate step. That through Buddhism you can come to devotional service, but Buddhism itself is not devotional service.
Yeah, they know devotion for Buddha first.
And that will bring them eventually to bhakti. But you can't say Buddhism itself is devotional service. We talked that just devotional service for Krishna, love for Krishna, can this is going to keep coming up again and again, can fulfill our desires, but what about a spiritual master such as Srila Prabhupada? Can we feel fulfilled by associating and serving our spiritual masters? Yes, because a bona fide spiritual master is a transcendental, transparent via media to Krishna. But a jiva is not akilata, akil rasa murti. You can't have all the 12 rasas with another jiva. You can't have a conjugal relationship with Srila Prabhupada. You can't have a buddy-buddy friendly cowherd boy relationship with Srila Prabhupada, unless you see him as a cowherd boy and you're a cowherd boy, but not in the ordinary sense. If you're thinking Srila Prabhupada or any other jiva is going to fulfill all my emotional needs and all my physical needs, it's not going to happen. and you'll be disappointed and you'll be bitter. But a jiva can, by being a transparent vine media to Krishna. So in that sense, yes. If your relationship with your spiritual master is as a transparent vine media to Krishna, yes. What is the difference between piety and agata sukriti if there is a difference? Yes, there's a difference. Although sukriti literally means piety and agata, or pious activities, and agata, unknowing. So ordinary, what we're talking about here, ordinary material piety is you're following the rules of the scriptures to go to heaven and have good birth. When we talk about transcendental sukriti and agata sukriti, we mean that you're doing things that are in bhakti, but you don't know they're bhakti. You don't really, you're not doing them to love Krishna. You're sort of unknowingly connecting without knowing. Your intentions are not favorable. You don't really know you're doing something for Krishna. You don't really know you're doing something for bhakti. You're eating a cookie, prasadam cookie, just because it tastes good. So that is something that can qualify you for bhakti. Yes? Because if you're engaged in the service of your guru or any Vaishnava, actually in relationship to Krishna, it's the same thing. It's the same thing. The difficulty is when you're serving a jiva, saying it's for Krishna, but it's not. Just like you can be serving Krishna and you're serving Krishna, but it's not pure bhakti. You can be serving Krishna in gyan-covered bhakti or karma-covered bhakti. You won't get what you're looking for. You can be serving Krishna with materially motivated desires. You won't get what you're looking for. If you're serving a jiva thinking that jiva is going to satisfy me, you're going to be very disappointed. You're going to be heartbroken. You're going to be bitter. You're going to be angry. It's not going to work. Even if that jiva is a Vaishnava. But if you're serving that jiva as part of your service to Krishna, with Krishna as the center. One interesting story, I'll end here. We have a couple more really good ones, but we'll get them tomorrow. There was this man called Ram Das Abilas, I think his name was. He was an impersonalist, and he was serving... Oh, fuck, I can't get this right. I think it was Raghunath Bhatta Goswami. It's one of the Goswamis. Pretty sure it was Raghunath Bhatta Goswami. And he was serving him. He was traveling along with him to Jagannath Puri to see Lord Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. And he was doing things like carrying Raghunath Bhatta Goswami's bags. And I think he was doing his laundry. And he was doing... And he was always chanting the name of Ram. He was constantly chanting, Ram, 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 Ram. And he was serving a pure devotee. He was doing menial service for a pure devotee. And he got to Jagannath Puri, and Lord Chaitanya completely ignored him. Gave him no mercy at all. Nothing. Because his whole mood was, I want to merge with Ram. I want to merge with Ram. I want to merge with Ram. So although he was serving a pure devotee and he was chanting the name of Ram, it wasn't interesting. Now, of course, eventually, that may have some effect. Prabhupada said, if you have association with a pure devotee, even if it's offensive, eventually you'll be free of your offenses and have that effect. But like sometimes I see with devotee marriages that people think, oh, if my husband is a devotee, then they're going to be like God for me. It's like they put more expectations than people have in a normal marriage. You know, in a normal marriage, somebody may realize my husband isn't God, and he's not going to satisfy all my desires. And sometimes when people marry a devotee, they think, oh, because he's a devotee. And then they see he can't satisfy all your desires. And sometimes he'll out and out irritate you. But if you're thinking, I'm serving Krishna by serving this devotee, and then if it comes to the point that you're actually serving Krishna together and facilitating each other's service, then your love for Krishna and your love for that devotee are there. You can hardly even separate them. It becomes part of that. But the mood is somewhat different. Okay, if those of you who didn't go to the samadhi and look at the panels, please do that. We'll be discussing that by Thursday. So absolutely by Thursday have done that. The 9 panels on who did the 9 processes. And tomorrow we're doing chapters 8, 9, and 10. There's 9. There's 9 panels.